Choice with Paige Nick on FMR.
He's going to be interviewing Juliet Prowse, the niece of Juliet Prowse, who wrote Born to Dance. And we play out the show, as I said, with global smash hit best-selling John Connolly is in the studio right here at Fine Music Radio to chat to Beryl Eichenberger about his latest novel and all his success. His latest is called The Children of Eve. So you're tuned into Book Choice. You're in absolutely the right place. We're going to bring you some beautiful books over lunchtime to whet your appetite. So let's see. Who did I say was up first? I think that's Shirley Guler. David Baldacci. You have to remember that name. He is a massive best-selling author. I think he must have started in the late 80s or early 90s. And Shirley read his latest. He's still trucking. It's called Strangers in Time. Shirley, does David Baldacci live up to the test of time?
This is truly a book to show there's light at the end of the tunnel. And it's a very different book to the David Baldacci ones that I know. There is, of course, tension in Strangers in Time, but a different kind of tension. There is an extra urgency that comes when one's time on Earth can be quickly curtailed by incoming bombs, resulting not only in death or severe disability, or loss not only of limbs, but of one's only family. It's scary when you're just a kid. The bleakness experienced everywhere in their darkening world is coupled with a hope for a better future, an optimism that unobtrusively transcends the horrors and hell. You wouldn't think there were too many parallels between wartime London and Cape Town today, but Baldacci's description of our homeless orphans, scavengers by force, eked out a living is how so many people of the pavements, his phrase, sadly not mine, must do it today. Bombed buildings equal makeshift tents beside the roads in this city of ours, where people living there are only just one step ahead of the cops. But I digress. Baldacci does make you think, and in this case he's infused a wartime atmosphere with spirit and life. He's created characters who experience the most unimaginable pain and grief, yet remain unconquered. He has brought together three people from polar opposite backgrounds to form a union that solidifies friendship, despite questioning and suspicions that have to be faced to be able to function. Molly, mature beyond her years at 15, Charlie, a rough, unschooled ruffian of 13, and the only adult in the room, the bookkeep's owner, Ignatius Oliver. They need each other to survive, to hear and handle those truths while others seek to thwart them. It's a loss that binds them, the loss of a wife, the lost will and potential of parents and grandparents, and the fear of the unknown. There are so many ups and downs as the real story is outed. Molly's happiness on her return from the countryside, she was for safety sent to 5 years before, is dashed when her parents aren't there to welcome her. This is part of the puzzle, of course. Charlie's street lawyer friendships are torn asunder, and Mr. Oliver needs to face his own demons, and with mentions of Bletchley Park and more sinister overtones. Each character has strength and weaknesses, and Baldacci manages to show that actually there is real goodness in everybody, even Charlie. His very desperation makes him steal, but his innate goodness makes him return the stolen property. Baldacci's descriptions of a London under siege are so realistic you would think the war ended last year. The air raid sirens, the overstretched air raid wardens, the overwhelmed first responders, the overcrowded underground station bomb shelters, all are as fresh as though they were part of our lives yesterday. You experience the explosions and destruction of the incoming bombers and V-2 rockets, perhaps amplified by the shocking battles today in Ukraine and Gaza, and you live and feel the terror and horrors that surrounded Covent Garden, Chelsea, and the London of 1944. The outcome is not all moonlight and roses, or even perhaps what one wished for or fully expected, but there is a huge sense of, well, that's fine then. They were survivors. And that leaves you with the question, are you?
Thank you so much, Shirley. While Shirley was telling us about David Baldacci's latest, I actually Googled and I saw that David Baldacci's first novel came out in 1996 and it was called Absolute Power. So he's still trucking. Next up, we go to another author, a big seller who's still trucking, but in an entirely different genre. Bernard Schlink is a major literary author. I'm sure you'll remember he wrote The Reader, was one of my favorite books that I remember being so shocked by the ending. And then remember they went and made a big movie out of that. So he has a new novel out. It's called The Granddaughter. Tell us all about it, Beverly Ruiz Muller.
Bernard Schlink's latest novel, The Granddaughter, is set in a reunified Germany yet still full of bitter divisions after the end of the Cold War. His earlier best-selling book, The Reader, was a masterpiece and also one of despair. There was no time in which I thought it would end well, and it didn't, even though I admired it very much. The Granddaughter takes a while to reveal its message, yet the slow beginning is an important prelude. In the divided Berlin of the early 1960s, a young student, Caspar, fell in love with a girl in the Eastern Sector and arranged to smuggle her to the West. Meanwhile, she discovered she was pregnant and, fearing it would ruin her escape, gave up the baby girl for adoption. Later they marry, and only after her death does Caspar find out about this child as he goes through her papers. In his determined quest to find the unknown girl, he discovers that she has led a troubled life and is also dead, but had handed her own baby daughter, the granddaughter of the title, to an old-fashioned family drenched in the traditional values of the GDR, packed with conspiracy theorists and racial hatred, totally believing that those ugly stories about Germany's conduct during World War II were faked by the wicked West. Caspar finds the granddaughter and, by agreeing to give her guardian some money, he calls it her inheritance. He manages to spend holidays with her in a more modern Germany. He shows her wonderful things, discovering she has a passionate and clever mind. But the arrogance and close-mindedness of her home, her refusal or inability to see another point of view, leaves him feeling impotent. How can he reach her? How do we negotiate such toxic beliefs without losing those we care about? This theme has a special lure for me, for in today's bitterly divided political world, where families and lovers are torn apart and generations won't speak to each other, how can we resolve such problems? It may require a human sacrifice of one's very heart and the wisdom and courage to do so. The granddaughter is allowed to spend holidays with him, hearing the great classical works she falls in love with, having piano lessons, for she is talented. But her ingrained belief lies in the folk and what she calls the guilt cult of Germans. She thinks it's all just self-hatred, a lack of self-respect by Germans for their great past and future. There is something in this, for Germany has a very long and interesting history. The problem is that those who raised her are in total denial about World War II and its atrocities. Caspar realizes that, in the trauma of her adoption and harsh childhood, she has been molded into a tempestuous shape he cannot control. All he can do is love her and help her escape after she has made some terrible choices. It also means that he will likely lose her again. This latest Schlink novel is a marvel with a warm, wise heart, easy to read and a very good translation. I find it rich both in writing and in emotional intelligence, and I planned to read it again, and I didn't feel that about The Reader. The Granddaughter by Bernard Schlink is a very impressive novel, a favorite of mine this year.
Next up, Vanessa Levenstein is here, and she's reviewing a book called Young Elizabeth by Nicola Tallis. So in this, best-selling author Nicola Tallis draws on primary sources, they say written by Elizabeth herself and her contemporaries, to provide this extensive and thorough study of what was an exceptionally resilient young girl whose early life would shape the queen she later became. This is a nuanced, this is what they say, this is the blurb, it's a nuanced, authentic, and utterly gripping biography that throws new light into the early life of this iconic monarch. Whenever I see books like this, I wonder if they've been waiting for her to pass on before they could write this stuff, because I know it's all such carefully hidden stuff. They don't really let it out into the open too much. The bio continues and says that it's a heart-racing story of Elizabeth's youth, as she steered her way through perilous waters towards England's throne in one of the most sensational of its time. Yeah, I'm not sure we'll ever have another queen quite like that. Welcome to the show, Vanessa Levenstein, with Young Elizabeth by Nicola Tallis.
The reading process often feels like a sandwich. The last book you read forms the bottom layer. The current book is the filling. Young Elizabeth, Princess, Prisoner, Queen by Nicola Tallis became the filling in my reading sandwich, shaped by the book's trilogy, brilliant, 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 and left me with a fascination for the court of Henry VIII. Of course, there have been Honeymantle II. Instead, she approaches Elizabeth's story as a historian. A quick glance at the detailed index reflects her meticulous research, yet the writing remains engaging and accessible. Elizabeth's formative years were not for the faint-hearted. We know the history. Henry VIII beheaded her mother, Anne Boleyn. Henry dies, Elizabeth's half-brother Edward dies, and her half-sister Mary imprisons Elizabeth. A whole lot more executions and political drama later, Elizabeth becomes queen. Tallis delves into Elizabeth's complex relationship with her father. For instance, in one of her letters to him, Elizabeth reveals an eagerness to earn his approval, which of course could also be attributed to the fact that she knew exactly what happened to people who crossed his path. This is where the final layer of the sandwich, or the book I read after Elizabeth, comes in. It's called Unlocking the Nature of Human Aggression, a psychoanalytical and neuroscientific approach by Adrian Perkel. He deconstructs the historical biographies of geopolitical tyrants together with the stories of serial killers. Over and over, there's that link between the perpetrator of the crime seeing themselves as, in fact, the victim. Now, if we were to apply Perkel's framework, my understanding would be Henry's paranoia drove him to eliminate perceived threats, while Mary's victimhood fueled her persecution of the Protestants. Yet Elizabeth, while she also eliminated her enemies for her own survival, violence wasn't what defined her. Instead, she created her own destiny and forged a remarkable legacy, which Tallis illustrates so beautifully. Young Elizabeth is a compelling portrait of a queen who, because of or in spite of her trauma, became one of England's most iconic monarchs. The book was, by all accounts, a most satisfying
stories, drawing on families left behind, lawyers on both sides of these stories, the judges who passed sentence, the warders on death row, and even functionaries tasked with informing the condemned of their impending fate. This is such a huge subject, death row, the death penalty. Hi, Riley Herbert.
Pretoria asks urgent questions about our justice system and its practitioners, both then and now. One of the most damning revelations in the book is how little has been done in the democratic era to honour or even recognise many of these individuals. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission overlooked many of them. Memorialisation has been inconsistent at best. The post-apartheid state, the book argues, has often failed the families of those who were executed in its name. Despite its heavy subject matter, Death in Pretoria is a compelling and accessible read. Alfter Haider writes with journalistic clarity and narrative verve, never losing sight of the human stakes. Each chapter feels intimate and urgent, a testament to his empathy and dedication. This is not just a book about death. It is a book about erasure, memory, and the need to tell stories that history tried to silence. Death in Pretoria is a landmark contribution to South African history and a vital act of restorative justice. It deserves to be widely read, discussed, and remembered. Death in Pretoria is written by Peter Alfter Haider and published in South Africa by Penguin Random House.
Afraid the rain will blow it all away, melting light, melting light in the rain. She can never bear to be in the world today. It's a shame, cause the rain doesn't like her face. So she whispers in my ear to remind me how she cares. It's that she's so afraid, she's so afraid of melting in the rain. I'm melting in the rain, melting like day, melting. melting light, melting light, melting light.
Welcome back. That was Melting in the Rain by Black Sunshine, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. So today's show is broken up into two main segments. The first, which we've just worked through, was all the reviews. We had some real big hitters, local and international. The second segment of this show is all interviews. We have three massive author interviews for today's show, two nonfiction and one fiction. Philip Todras is here first, and he's going to chat to John Manning about a new book out. It's called Proteas of the Fynbos, and this fills our wonderful nature slot for this week's show. I was thinking about it, and I think next to maybe dahlias and cactuses, I'm a fan of a succulent, proteas are some of my most favorite flowers. I was just traveling overseas, and every now and then you'll see proteas overseas, and they give me such a sense of pride to know that they're all ours and we're importing them mostly to the rest of the world. So, Philip Todras and John Manning, tell us all about Proteas of the Fynbos.
Proteas of the Fynbos by John Manning, and I've got the man himself. South African National Biodiversity Institute, I gather, is the background, and not your first book either. So tell us about how Proteas of the Fynbos came into being.
Well, Philip, it's a commission from Strake Nature, and it's the second in a series of wildflower guides. The first one was on Erica's, which came out a year ago, and it's been doing really well. So we're very interested in having a protea guide because there isn't one, and obviously you know how iconic they are in the South African psyche and internationally. So hence this book.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your credentials to be able to write this book.
Well, I'm a scientist, a botanist, taxonomist, more precisely at the South African National Biodiversity Institute at Kirstenbosch. I've been working there as a botanist for 40 years and have written many, many wildflower guides, hopefully every one a little improvement on the previous. And that's how I got into this one, and we had access to an amazing photographic archive of all the proteas of the Fynbos, from which we could draw, plus a lot of new images. So there
and
we are.
And I gather you're a photographer yourself, but for this book you have a special photographer.
Yes, most of them are from the late Colin Patterson-Jones, who had a particular interest in proteas and illustrated several previous wildflower guides.
So there's a little historical context as a footnote. Now tell us, as you say, the reasons for the book and what I'd find, why I would use it.
The aim on this book is to help both amateurs and more proficient people, because there's a big contingent of plant lovers in the country now who are fairly sophisticated in their knowledge. So we had to straddle two audiences and have the book very attractive and very easy to use for people who are just coming into the field, but also containing technical information that's important for some of the more specific identifications and that would appeal to the more sophisticated reader. So it's a whole mixture of stuff, including lots of very interesting and novel surrounding information about where proteas originated, how old the family is, what all the characters are that you use to identify them, some really interesting historical aspects about the Fynbos proteas, And yes, a whole mixed bag of stuff that should appeal to everybody.
But also what impressed me was you've categorized it. And do you want to just comment on the various categories?
Thanks, Philip. We developed a system to lead the user into the whole field. How do you identify the groups of proteas? And then once you're in that group, how do you navigate your way through all those species? So following the little prompts, you can get a long way and very quickly.
Some of the categories that, you know, just make it more helpful for me. I want to know, I don't know very much about this. I love looking at them. So how would I find my way around your book?
Oh, yeah, good question. Well, when we call it Proteas of Fynbos, we're meaning all members of the Protea family. So the first way of grouping them is into the genera, the pincushions and the real proteas and the cone bushes.
You said real proteas?
The genus Protea.
Okay, so the others are sort of...
The others are members of the family, but they're not in the genus Proteus. So pincushions are in the genus Leucospermum, pagoda bushes are in the genus Mimetes, and that kind of thing. So once you get into the genus, which is the little bigger grouping than the species, we lead you into the different clusters of species, how do you tell them apart, and so on, until you get down to the exact species you're looking for.
By the way, just a thought came to me. Are you going to be doing a launch in one of your talks at Kirstenbosch about this?
The launch was actually just over a month ago, and we had a launch in Kirstenbosch Gardens and at the Betty's Bay Botanical Garden with a talk and an illustrated slideshow introducing the book.
Okay. And you won't be doing talks along the way somewhere, but we'll get to that
another time. No, I think you're very unique having one on the radio here.
Okay, even better. And I was fascinated by... Especially the photographs are so special and the sense of context it provides. I thought that was quite amazing. It's not just a textbook. It's more than that.
You've really picked up on one of the aspects of it. Some of the details are of the flowers or the flower heads, but in Proteus, it's very important to look at the growth form of the whole plant. And so we've included those images as well. So you can see what they look like in the field, what the whole plant looks like, and then the details of the flowers. And then introductory sections have all sorts of, cover all sorts of aspects, including the seeds and the pollination and the ecology and a lot of interesting stuff. So well done, yeah.
Well, I think the other thing that is important to me is by focusing on this treasure chest and making it more accessible, perhaps people are more conscious of it, more conscious of having to protect it.
I think you're right. It's one of the most endangered families. Two species are extinct. One was known only from Weinberg Hill and was last seen in the early 1800s. So, yes, conservation is a very big issue with them.
Well, congratulations on a wonderful book and also a very practical book. I love the little detail that on the back is even a ruler, so you can do some measurements as well. And it's quite heavyish, but you can certainly put it in your rucksack and take it around with you. So, compliments to you, John Manning, and to the books Proteas of the Fynbos. Let's get that right. Proteas of the Fynbos by John Manning. And it is available, and get out there and get yourself a copy.
It's published by Strake Random House.
Good, and obviously available at Kirstenbosch and all other places. Okay, thank you.
Fascinating stuff about Proteas. Thank you so much, Philip Todras and John Manning. Next up, we have our second interview of today's show. We have three interviews. This one, Twanji Kulula is joining us, and the book that Twanji wanted to cover is called Born to Dance. That's the title of this biography. And it's about the life of Juliet Prowse, who was a South African dancer and actress. This has been written by her niece, Juliet E. Prowse. And the book details Prowse's early life, her rise to fame after being discovered in Paris, and she was cast in the film Can-Can, and her subsequent huge career in Hollywood and Las Vegas. It also explores her personal life, including her engagement to Frank Sinatra, and her marriage after that to actor John McCook. So, going to be some beautiful insights into this book here. This interview with Juliet E. Prowse, the niece of Juliet Prowse, brought to us by Twanji Kulula.
As the golden era of Hollywood came to a close at the end of the 50s, a South African star by the name of Juliet Prowse danced her way to global fame, appearing in films and on TV, headlining Vegas acts, and garnering global headlines. She was rumored to have romanced Elvis Presley, she was engaged to Frank Sinatra, and she was married to John McCook, who South Africans know better as The Bold and the Beautiful's Eric Forrester. Now her life has been shared in full by her niece Juliet E. Prowse, the daughter of her only brother, who has penned a biography that details her professional triumphs and disappointments, as well as her intriguing personal life. And Juliet, I believe your mother Kathy is also a huge fan of Fine Music Radio, so it's such a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I was so fascinated by how the book came together almost by accident. You discovered a little treasure trove that kind of kicked it off. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Basically, my parents were moving from one house to a retirement house. And in the house was a little red suitcase. My nieces called it Paddington suitcase. And in that was a whole bunch of newspaper articles that my aunt, Juliet Prowse, the dancer, had sent my grandmother, who actually, interestingly, lived next door to us when I was growing up. So throughout her career. So it was this fascinating find. And I started wading through it and wanting to just see initially what happened to her in the 50s.
Yes.
She went over as a 17-year-old to London. And that's really what set off the project. Once I started collating some of the quotes, I thought, there's a story in this.
What's so fascinating for me is there was a lot of research that she did, obviously, through the letters and articles written about her hundreds and hundreds and hundreds over the years. But you've also shared a name with her your whole life, particularly during the peak of her fame when she was a huge star. And what was that like? Because I imagine you've been telling bits and pieces of her stories for many years.
Yes, so she was really well known, I'd say, in the 60s and 70s. Also, it was probably in the 80s, but her career started sort of tailing off a bit. So whenever I said my name, I would always get, oh, there's a famous actress dancer by that name. And when I was young, I was a bit, ooh, I didn't really know how to respond to it. But I eventually really started enjoying it and just sort of saying, yes, she's my aunt. You know, and then obviously lately, yes, and I've written a book about her.
Please go out and get it,
yes,
I'm sure.
Yes.
What was fascinating for me as I was reading it was that you were also quite close during times in your life. You had spent time in America and you'd had conversations about life. And it must have been quite interesting to kind of meet her all over again in a different, more vulnerable way through these letters. What was that part of writing this book like?
It was actually amazing, and mainly with the letters, because she's a down-to-earth, like, easygoing woman, and she shared stuff with her mom, my grandmother. Mm-hmm. So I'd be, like, just reading, and then suddenly could be that she was elated at getting an award or super disappointed that she'd done so well in Sweet Charity, the musical. Mm. She played the role of Charity in London and Vegas, got so much publicity, and then she thought the opportunities would be rolling in, and they weren't quite, you know, it was the late 60s. Mm. So she would share, yeah, sometimes I'd just cry because of what she was going through. Other times, I'd just laugh out loud. She went to see Michael Caine in Alfie and decided, she wrote him a letter and invited him to come and see her because he was going to be her next man.
And I don't know whether it's just inherently the part of the South African spirit, but the one thing that really surprised me was that on the one hand, you painted a picture of her as being very grounded and down to earth, but she's also very gutsy. I mean, she really became one of the biggest stars in the world for those couple of decades. What do you think drove her success? Like, what had she figured out at that early age that kind of paved the way for this huge career?
Yes, I think that she loved dancing more than anything. Mm. I think that really. And then she loved dancing so much. I mean, readers will read how she basically was in primary school and she was starting to go to Johannesburg from Vereeniging on her own, on a bus.
Yeah, bravely.
Yes. But it also meant that her schooling suffered. Mm. So she left school before matric. Mm. And I think it was partly, well, it's just that she loved dance more than anything. And I think she got acknowledged quite early on. The fact that she was one of the youngest dancers in festival ballet in Johannesburg and then in London, and that helped her. Yeah, there was just a drive. I think it came from her mother, my grandmother as well, about just, you know, striving for the best kind of thing.
And then, of course, I mean, there's the interest in all the men that she dated along the way. And what struck me about that was that she seemed quite comfortable around kind of these huge personalities and huge figures, and she kind of held her own. But as you're putting this book together, what were you hoping that readers would ultimately take away from the story? I mean, of course, it is interesting to hear about what, you know, a relationship with Elvis Presley might look like. But I imagine there was more that you wanted people who read about her to walk away with.
See, the initial drive to create the book was because she died in 1996 and she has three grandchildren that can read about her, but they don't know the character. I obviously knew the character, so she was funny. She was a lovely aunt to have, and I wanted to almost depict that in some way. So that was sort of one objective. But probably the overriding objective was because she wasn't a movie star, per se. Yes. She was in movies. She was in G.I. Blues with Elvis Presley. She's less well known, but she had this huge contribution towards the world of dance.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to almost just document that, and maybe some younger dancers who don't know about her actually get a sense of what... She was a dancer that had her own show for 21 years in Vegas and won awards 4 times.
And beat the biggest names. Yeah, like Liza Minnelli, Barbara Streisand. You know, it's a huge career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was really what I wanted to leave as a legacy for her.
Well, I really enjoyed reading it. I do think that you managed to balance her personal life with also documenting the history of the time as well. I mean, it was a very challenging industry for a young woman who was 17, who, as you said, barely finished high school. But she managed to kind of make it through, and I think that was you captured it well.
It was interesting because So when I started with newspaper articles, almost all of them were just positive quotes. And I thought, this is not a rounded person. I need to somehow capture the rounded person besides all the fabulous quotes. And then obviously weave in the history of the entertainment industry as it changed. The book extends over 4 decades.
Thank you so much for that. I think it's a very fair portrayal of her life. I think the triumphs and successes, as well as the hurts and disappointments. Born to Dance by Juliet E. Prowse was published by Prowse Media and retails for 310 Rand.
And with that incredible interview, insightful interview, we head into our final interview for today's show. And this is a big one. We are very, very fortunate to have had this author in the studio. He is a best-selling author of mystery and supernatural fiction. John Connolly is his name. He is a household name. I'm sure you will recognize his name. He has over 30 published works, including the popular Charlie Parker series. His books have captivated readers around the world for decades. He's won many, many awards. And he's published, this is interesting, and he's published more UK Sunday Times top 10 hardback bestsellers than any other Irish writer. How fascinating is that? More top 10 hardback bestsellers than any other Irish writer. So I was curious, and I Googled how many books has John Connolly sold. I mean, with 30 published works and he's a bestseller, I'd be very curious to know that. Interestingly enough, the internet kicked back that while the exact total number of books sold by John Connolly isn't readily available, he has reportedly sold 13.5 million euros worth of books in Ireland and the UK alone. So that's a lot of books. His debut novel, Every Dead Thing, was published almost 18 years ago. So this guy's been trucking for a really long time, and he knows what he's doing. So how lucky are we to have him in the studio today? Beryl Eichenberger joins John Connolly to chat about his latest novel and his massive success. Welcome to the show, John Connolly. We are so excited to have you here.
Thrillers, crime, mystery, a genre that attracts a huge following. But when the addition of the supernatural and a splash or two of horror creeps in, then there is plenty to mull over. Irish author John Connolly has made this genre his own, and his private investigator character, Charlie Parker, has touched many souls. Charlie is a uniquely likable man. John's latest book in the series is The Haunting, The Children of Eve, a mix that will enthrall and possibly keep you awake at night. An absolute privilege to welcome the creator himself, John Connolly, into the studio.
Thank you very much. I might have the creator put on my business card.
Yes, I think so.
That would be great.
I think that would actually be perfect. So I also read, I can't remember the name of the book because my brain has gone completely dead now, Twice Upon a Time. Is how some story should continue.
The Land of Lost Things. Thank God I'm here to help you.
That's what you're here for.
You'd be lost without me.
I really liked this sort of beginning and felt it has application in most of your novels. And Charlie's perhaps 24 upon a time?
24 upon a time by this stage. Yes, I think it is. I've been publishing for 26 years now. Mm. It seems very odd to still be talking about him after all this time because I didn't conceive of it in those terms. You know, it's quite lovely. And you don't get 26 years unless readers find something to connect with in the character, because I think sometimes people who don't read mystery fiction or genre fiction are quite dismissive of it and think, well, it's all about plot. But actually, all good fiction is about character.
Oh, and most definitely, I could not agree with you more. I mean, where did Charlie come from in the first place?
Never underestimate the power of a chip on the shoulder for getting anything done. Contented people don't tend to... I think contentment is very underrated. I'm at the stage of my life, when I'm in my late 50s now, where you'll take contentment. But when you're younger, you need a little bit of a spur. And I had been a journalist. I was a better writer than I was a journalist, I think it would be fair to say. My heart wasn't in journalism. And I began writing. I sat down one day out of frustration and began writing about a man going to a cemetery with flowers in the back of his car. And that was all I had. I didn't have a name.
It just came to you.
Yeah, that was when I sat down, that was what I wanted to write. And I had the first 500 or 600 words. And then I thought, you know, there's a kind of, well, where is he going? And who is he visiting? And then over a period of about 4 years, the book was written. Mm. But I didn't sit down and do a kind of, you know, the dummy's guide to
are
character.
Are you a pantser?
I see. It's funny. Now we're going to have a falling out. To do with planning and not planning. I'm not very good at thinking very far ahead. I genuinely am not. I don't play chess, for example. My mind doesn't quite work that way. So I tend to know the beginning of a book. But I often think, you know, that there are writers who are... There's one particular British writer who gets very, very annoyed. I won't say her name, Sophie Hannah, who gets very annoyed with writers who she can't conceive of somebody who would produce a mystery novel without having everything delineated at the beginning. Yeah, seat of the pants writing is what some people call it.
Yeah, pants.
But actually, it's exactly the opposite of that, because you have to be very slow and very methodical to write this way, because you don't have a plan going forward. And so for me, the writing of the book is almost like a reflection of the way Parker investigates the crime. Parker doesn't know what's happening in 2 weeks or 20 chapters.
True.
All he does is he goes out and he asks a question. And on the basis of that question, he moves on to the next stage. And that's exactly how the writing of the book is for me. And so the process of discovery is what interests me the most in the book. It's very difficult. And I know you may have readers who are probably want to write. And some years ago, I remember... The Irish academic mafia took over a university in Liverpool and said to me, have you ever thought about teaching? And I kind of really hadn't, but I thought it might be interesting to try. And I realized I had told these kids everything I knew about writing in about the first 2 minutes. And therefore, taking 3 years of money was like the equivalent of Trump University levels of corruption and dishonesty. And so I had to walk away. But I can probably actually fit it in. There are some essential truths about creativity in writing. And the first is that I'm now writing my 41st book. And every one of those books, I've wanted to throw it away after 20,000 words. I'm at that stage now. I'm kind of about 50,000 words. I don't know where I'm going. I still don't know the ending of the book. I'm trapped in the middle of it. And there's a little voice in my head going, you know, this wasn't a very good idea. And this is where you get found out. So set it aside and start again as a false start. And I think people who are trying to write sometimes think that writers or creative people don't experience that doubt. But actually, doubt is integral to the process. And what I have learned is that the new idea will always be more appealing than the one you're struggling with.
Right.
And we are all creative people. Even if you're just a reader, or if you're engaged with music, that in itself is a creative act. But you are born with a finite amount of creative confidence as a practitioner. And every time you abandon a project, you chip away a little piece of that confidence and you never get it back. And so you end up with a drawer filled with literal and figurative fragments. So you have to learn to finish what you start. I think it was Salman Rushdie who said, actually, professional writers are amateurs who finish things. So if you can plan, that process of doubt is less profound. Because you have a roadmap, but I don't. So I live with that doubt all the way through the first draft.
But you research very heavily, because in The Children of Eve, because... We're running out of time, as we always do. We could talk for an hour. In The Children of Eve, there's an enormous amount about artifacts and archaeological digs and cartels and all the rest of it. And that must have taken a lot of research to know all of those things, because you go into such depth. And the children actually don't appear much before the middle of the book. So you're not quite sure...
No,
what is going on?
And the mystery of the book is, who are the children?
Who are the children?
What is their nature?
Exactly.
You know, I'm a magpie, like most writers.
Yes.
And I accumulate shiny things.
And memories, you say.
And so the book is the accumulation of stuff over about 15 years. And when you say, yes, there is a lot of research in it, the trick is to throw out 95% of it and not overwhelm the reader with research. Mm. And the little pieces that you use as astutely as possible and with the maximum effect.
Well, you certainly achieve... that, goodness, what's going on there and who are these people? I mean, there is a lot of violence, which I know a lot of people really enjoy. I do. I'm a skitskopuntona, as they call us in South Africa. And I
thank God there's a desk between us. Good grief.
And just a very quick one. How much more of Charlie Parker and his friends Is there more coming?
There is more coming, but the story deserves a conclusion, and his story deserves a conclusion.
Yes.
So it is moving towards an ending, and all I can hope is that for readers it won't be disappointing, it will be a satisfactory ending.
And I have to say that I love the supernatural in it. It just gives it an edge. Thank you for that.
You're very, very kind. Thank you so much.
The Children of Eve is published by Hodder and Stoughton, distributed by Jonathan Ball, and is in good bookstores now.
And that showstopper of an interview brings us to the end of the show. I think it was a big one. I'd like to thank Mzuu Makeza for building our show this week, and he's also going to load the show as a podcast onto fmr.co.za. So if you missed any of the titles of the books that we mentioned and you'd like to have another listen, you can find it on fmr.co.za. I also really want to extend a massive, huge thanks to Exclusive Books, who are the sponsors of this show. Exclusive Books have been sponsoring this show for over 4 years, and we couldn't be more grateful. It's a match made in heaven, because there isn't a book that we won't cover. And, you know, if there's a book you truly seek, you'll find it at Exclusive Books. So there isn't a book they won't cover either. So they just have shelves and shelves of the most magnificent reads. You can go into any of their stores countrywide. If you don't live near a store, they also have a fantastic online presence. They're on all the social medias. They do lots of giveaways. They have incredible author events. This is another thing that a listener, if you feel like getting out of an evening just for an hour, go have a free glass of wine or go in mid-morning for a coffee morning, Exclusive Books hold phenomenal author events. You can go hear the authors chatting about their books. They're entirely free. Sometimes there are snacks, lots of like-minded people, and it's just a fun way to spend an hour or two of your time. So do check out Exclusive Books online and you can see what they've got lined up. Thank you for your sponsorship, Exclusive Books. Without you, I'm not quite sure where we would be. And, of course, before we wrap up, I need to thank all our reviewers so much for joining us on today's show. Also, all our interviewers and, of course, the incredible authors and publishers who've joined us to help make this such a memorable show. I think it was a powerful one. And with that, that brings us to the end of the show. My name is Paige Nick. I've been the host today of Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. And we're going to play out with Blue Fountain by the Soweto String Quartet. Until we speak again, until we read again, happy reading. Thank you.